This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
It's a great pleasure to catch up with old friend Jack Lessenberry, whom you hear on Michigan Radio. He heads the journalism department at Wayne State University, still writes columns for newspapers in the area. Jack, welcome back to the show.
Always glad to be here.
When you do your commentaries for Michigan Radio, how do you become inspired, or what leads you to opine about certain topics?
Well, if I don't write them, they don't pay me, so that's always a powerful inventor. But I try to do things that are of the most interest to the most people possible, that are both interesting and significant. And I try to give people a range of topics. I try to surprise people sometimes and to have something new. When you do that 5 days a week, it's kind of a challenge, but the blessing is that our state is making so much news, especially in the last few years, that you very seldom run out of stuff.
Let's talk about a couple of the topics in the news. There are so many. You've written a lot recently about the minimum wage, for example. We all hear so many things in so many places. In your mind, what is the issue there?
Well, it's sort of, you can see both sides of this issue in some ways. Employers never want to pay their employees any more than they have to. There's some legitimate concern, I think, that some people will actually lose their jobs, although economic data shows that mostly hasn't been the case. There may be an exception in some, say, the restaurant industry, for example, depending on how high the minimum wage for tip people go. But people are having a harder and harder time making ends meet. And it's sort of hard. The current minimum wage in Michigan, I think it's $7.40 an hour. That works out to about $15,000 a year if you work full-time. Well, as I said in the radio, a goldfish can't live on that these days, which is a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much. I mean, if you are a young person, you live with your parents, you might be able to make it on that. But you can't, if you have any kind of a family, you can't find an apartment and survive on that. And you think that the one big thing we've gradually come to realize over the last 30 years, one of the big economic stories has been the transfer of wealth from the lower 50% to the upper 1%. And some people think, including me, I'll say, that it's only fair that people in America have a living wage and that people are able to sort of afford the necessities of life.
Do you see this playing out, that it will be raised then?
I think it's a very complex issue in Michigan. There are a lot of different factors. It's not just a simple, do you think the minimum wage should be raised or not? If not, how much? Republicans, by and large, don't want to raise the minimum wage. They initially started out against it, but now they're proposing some raising. In fact, the Michigan Senate passed an increase that would raise it by $1.80 an hour over the next 2.5 years. For two reasons. Partly, they want to knock off this ballot initiative. Now, it's pretty clear there's going to be an initiative on the ballot that would raise it to $10.10. And the main thing they object to in that is that it also raises it for people like waitstaff. And they think that would be sort of a job killer in the restaurant industry. Privately, they may not admit this publicly, but for everybody else, they can stand the $10.10 wage increase. But the other thing beyond that, if this is on the ballot, and polls show there's a lot of sentiment for raising it, this could produce a flood of turnout at the polls for people who would not normally vote. Democrats have a hard time getting their people to vote in off-year elections. And if those people come out for the minimum wage, they're not going to be voting for Rick Snyder. They're not going to be voting for Terry Lynn Land, and they know that. And there's a historical example. In 2000, Betsy DeVos, against John Engler's opposition, forced putting this question about vouchers for private schools on the ballot. What happened? A huge number of Democrats turned out. They thought that Bush had a good chance to carry Michigan. Wasn't even close. And Debbie Stabenow defeated Spencer Abraham because of that. So they don't want a repeat of that.
Jack Lessenberry, what about Detroit? Another issue you've commented on a lot. Where are we? Where do you see it going?
You know, that's something that we could probably fill 19 hours with and not have any kind of solution. Of course, the question right now is the whole issue of they don't want to call it a bailout, but it's sort of a supplement to the pension funds that would save the DIA and shore up these pension funds. And will the state put in either $350 million over 20 years or $195 million lump sum? That's the big question. For me, though, that's not the big question. The big question is, okay, at some point in time, the bankruptcy will be over, sooner rather than later, probably by this fall. So that's over. Then what? How does Detroit stay solvent, let alone get prosperous? Because at the end of the day, Detroit is still going to be a very poor city with a lot of people who are not very employable. They won't be able to borrow money, having gone through a bankruptcy. How do they then get back on their feet? And they'll probably be shorn of some assets. And Governor Snyder realizes that. Now, he didn't get any votes in Detroit. He's not going to get any votes in Detroit. But he's a businessman, and he'll tell you that if Detroit isn't fixed to the extent that it's at least functional and not sort of like a poster child for failed urban horror, it's very hard to attract new business industry to Michigan. And some of the people in the legislature don't see that, but he certainly sees that. And then there are a lot of people who want to help Detroit because they say it's the right thing to do. So my prediction is that despite your extreme youth, Russ White, you're not going to live to see the end of Detroit's problems.
Jack Lessenberry with me on MSU today. Jack, roads, our Michigan roads are another issue. How do you see that one playing out?
Well, so far they've played out for me to one $260 tire on Woodward Avenue in Royal Oak going 30 miles an hour. So I have some personal bias, I should say. It was very interesting. The Republicans started talking about giving a tax cut when they had this surplus, which now has vanished. And they heard from their constituents, even solid Republican constituents, fix the roads. We don't want a meaningless tax cuts. Fix the roads. So the question is, how much are they going to fix the roads? Now, they've cobbled together $450 million, $500 million from existing funds. That won't do it. The governor says, he said this 2 years ago, you need $1.2 billion a year for 10 years just to get the roads, not for new roads, just to get these roads where they should be. And every year you put it off, it's kind of like having a cavity. If you go to the dentist right away, it's a minor thing. If you don't, it's root canal time, and I've had 9 root canals. I know what I'm talking about. And so the highway people say it's now closer to $2 billion a year. Now, there's a move in the state Senate to kick that up to $1.2, $1.3 billion a year, but it's very hard to see how do you do that without new revenue. And, you know, we talk about taboos. Apparently a big taboo is saying you're going to raise taxes. Now, if you go out and you take polls, I've done this again and again, you ask people, would you be in favor of raising taxes to fix the roads? It's like 85% yeah, because people are paying more than they'd pay in taxes because of these bad roads, and we're cursing all the time and getting alignments all the time. So I think something is going to have to happen because there's going to be some kind of a citizens' revolt.
Jack, is our legislature both in the state and nationally, I guess, more so, is it more partisan and dysfunctional than ever before, or has it always been this way?
The long answer is yes. It's worse than ever. And it's worse than ever not because of the people there. It's worse than ever for two main things. One is the districts are now so gerrymandered that the vast majority of them, the only action is in the primary, both Democratic and Republican districts. So there's no incentive to compromise. In fact, there's an incentive to be as radical as possible, or the crazies of the left or the right, and I think this is especially a problem for the Republicans, may punish you in a primary. There's also term limits. Term limits, with the possible exception of athlete's foot, is the single worst thing to happen in the history of the universe. And the reason for that is roughly the main, there's roughly two big reasons. One, no institutional memory. When I was a child and I covered the legislature in the late 70s and early 80s, there were about a dozen people on each side, and they were lifers. They weren't going to go to Congress. They knew that. And they had some dedication to a higher cause than partisanship. So after a certain amount of silliness, they'd get everybody in the room and say, all right, damn it, Mary, you got to live with this. Joey, you get this, and you got to give up that. They don't have that anymore. And you can stay now a maximum of 6 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate. Human nature. It's like kids in a dorm room. They don't care about trashing the dorm room. They're not going to live there forever. And if they can kick a problem down the road 10 years, that's what they'll do because they won't be there. Well, they've been doing that for 20 years, and now, you know, some very big genetically enhanced chickens have come home to roost, and we're all paying the price. So this is a bad thing. And what we need is more sort of civic spirit than this. And idea, Michigan is, we're all in this together. Republicans and Democrats both have to realize that. And the people need to find some way of demanding that. If I were a dictator, the first two things I would do was either get rid of or severely modify term limits. Now, Ohio has term limits, but what their term limits are, after two terms, you have to sit out one, but then you can come back. And so you have some people with a lot of experience. And I would also have an independent, nonpartisan, bipartisan commission to draw district lines. Not only is this fair from a partisan standpoint, but we now have, for example, Kalamazoo and Battle Creek should be in the same congressional districts. They were for forever and ever. Now they're divided. They have a lot of things in common, whereas we have a district in the Detroit area called the 14th District that has communities in it that have absolutely nothing in common with each other, with people who never go to the other parts of the district, and it is just crazy. But it's done for sort of maximum partisan advantage. We shouldn't be doing that. And we can fix it if we want to and if we have the will to.
Michigan Radio and Wayne State University's Jack Lessenberry with me on MSU Today. Well, are you hopeful? Are you optimistic? Can this ever change?
Well, I'm an old curmudgeon and an old man. But you know what? Whenever you're least optimistic, if you had put that microphone in my face 10 years ago and said, will you live to see a black president? I would have said, I don't think so. And then if you said, I'm going to predict the next president of the United States is a guy that no one's ever heard of, who is black, whose father is a Muslim from Kenya, and whose middle name is Hussein, I would say you need to get over to the Olin Health Center as soon as possible. But those turned out to be true. I'm optimistic that the roads are going to be fixed. They're going to have some sanity about that. And I think you have to be optimistic. You have to be sort of, you know, practice. The Russians used to say, trust but verify. You have to be optimistic, but also have very, very shrewd and sort of take the long view. It's not two steps forward, one step back. It's maybe 15,000 steps forward and 14,999 back, but you have to hope for a little bit of progress. And the thing that bothers me a lot, since we're here at MSU, is what I'm worried about is the future of kids being able to pay for their education without incurring, you know, a lifetime full of loan debt. And it really aggravates me that we haven't done more to make college affordable.
And, Jack, I'm not asking you to give away any of your next commentaries or anything, but what else are you kind of thinking about when you're laying up at night staring at the ceiling sometimes? What just concerns you about anything?
I wish we had some leaders in this state, not just political leaders, who sort of had a huge, broad view of Michigan, maybe the country, our place in the world, but you know, and I have to guard against being an old you-know-what, because I know I'm technically an old you-know-what, and you remember all this, and I don't want to be one of those guys on the park bench with a baseball cap saying, it's better in the old days, right. We canned our own vegetables. No, but I think I wish we had some leaders of the stature, say, of Bill Milliken or of Phil Hart or people who were sort of beyond partisanship. We have some of those people on an academic level sometimes, but it's harder. There's so much background noise, they tend to be drowned out. But this is, you know, we forget how wonderful a state this is. We have 10 million people. That's twice as many people as the whole United States had in 1800. We've got some of the most beautiful scenery. I did a television program a couple of years ago with the tourism directors of Ohio and Michigan, and the guy from Michigan is talking about Charlevoix and Petoskey and Painted Rocks and everything that we have here and the Irish Hills and the Sleeping Bear Dunes. And the guy from Ohio says, we got Cedar Point. Cedar Point's pretty cool. You should go to Cedar Point. So most states can't touch Michigan in terms of what we have. And we've got this huge manufacturing workforce and a really potential for a good quality of life for a lot of people. We just have to figure out how to get more people that. And I think on a political basis, some people who have good lives need not to be so selfish, and some people need to take more responsibility for their actions. But I tend to find if I'm around a lot of liberals, I start feeling like a conservative, and if a lot of conservatives, I feel pretty liberal. But we sort of lose sight. It's real easy to lose sight of the big picture. You know, that's something Michigan State has always. Michigan State has been a school that was invented to help the people of the state of Michigan. And it also, you know, is an intellectual powerhouse. It is not just an ag school. You're going to have the world's most, is it correct to call it a superconducting cyclotron facility? Biggest, you know, development in physics in the world. You've got you know, world-class scientists and sociologists and other people here. But it's also a place where you can learn practical things, where you can become a veterinarian, where you can learn to make a living. And people have been doing that here since the Civil War, since before the Civil War. And so I think it's sort of a model for Michigan. Michigan State really in some ways. Now, I have a graduate degree from the University of Michigan. I teach at Wayne State, so I'm pretty ecumenical. I was here as an undergrad. But Michigan State in many ways is the University of Michigan serving all of Michigan. That's a model that I think all of us at lots of levels should adopt.
Well, Jack, you're kind of the poster boy for the URC then, which is all those three research universities working together. But let's talk about your role at Wayne State, because journalism is a topic near and dear to both of our hearts as you're in it every day. At least the newspaper business a bit under siege in the internet age. But what's sort of the state of journalism in your mind, and where is it headed?
You know, as a real young kid, I wanted to be a paleontologist. I wanted to study dinosaurs. And I was fascinated by prehistoric life until I realized that I had the mathematical abilities of a dinosaur. And on my calculator, I could do addition, but they said that's not good enough, so I became a journalist. But the world of journalism today reminds me of the world at the end of the age. All the dinosaurs died, the comet or whatever it was killed them. There was a period of time when it wasn't clear what the next dominant life force would be. There are all these strange creatures running around, little mammals, you know, birds, these giant weird things that existed for a while. I think that's where we are in journalism. Conventional newspaper journalism has taken a huge hit economically. The traditional economic model has failed, and newspapers have laid off tens of thousands of people. Some have closed. All of them have diminished circulation. But newspapers are still the producers of 90%+ of all the content. Internet and search engines like Google produce nothing. They aggregate it. And ironically, the internet is driving, you know, the people gathering the golden eggs are starving the geese to death. And so that's sort of scary. I have to think at some point there'll be a stabilization that you'll have an internet newspaper model or a news model that works economically. You'll probably have multi-platform stuff. There's still going to be a market for print media for some years, for some people, maybe for a long time. But we have to find a way of making that work. And for my students, you know, in our time, it was much simpler. You get a job. Okay, I'll get a J school, and I'll get a job either on a little tiny newspaper or a 1-watt radio station, and then I'll do very well, and I get to a bigger one, and then to a medium-sized one, and eventually I'll get to a big newspaper, and I'll be set. And I'll go, maybe if my career is wildly successful, I'll go to the Washington Post, and I'll cover Congress, maybe the White House. But that would be all that you would do, and you would do that and retire from that, maybe write a book. Nowadays, everybody's multimedia. Nowadays, media institutions are going out of business. People want independent contractors. They want freelancers. They don't want employees. And so what we have to teach our students nowadays is that you need to learn these skills. And if you come out of here with this package of skills, if you can write and you can be multimedia and you know social media and you can do PowerPoint and you can do all these things, you're going to make a living. You will probably use these skills in a variety of ways. You may get a staff job for a while. You may not. You may not get one right away. But you're going to have to sort of – Thomas Friedman, the great New York Times journalist, author of The World is Flat, I got to talk to him a couple of years ago at one of the Mackinac conferences. He's a year younger than me and a lot richer. And he said, you know, you and I got out of school and we had to find a job. Our kids get out of school and they have to create a job. And that's sort of what's happening in journalism. My big fear is that – today on the internet, you can get more Barack Obama news than ever or Jennifer Aniston news than ever. You can't get news about what the Okemos City Council is doing by and large. The little papers that covered that, and I used to be the vice president of a company that published them, the Town Criers, that's pretty extinct. And that's pretty scary because for most people, most news is local. I hate to break it to you, Russ, but whatever Lindsay Lohan does is not going to affect your life materially. The Mason City Council does, what the Meridian Township Board of Commissioners do, may affect our lives big time, whether your kids are getting a good education at Okemos High School and higher education budget. I do an exercise to my class. I say, what's up with Lady Gaga? And they all know. And I'll say, okay, who are the people running the committees on higher education in Lansing, and what do they stand for? And they look at me like I could have said it in Turkish. I get the same response. They don't even know their higher education committees. They don't know who these people are. I say, what they do can have a vast impact on your lives, having to do with things like tuition. Nothing that Lady Gaga ever does is going to do anything that mildly amuse you. And then they slowly start to get it. So I think we've got to – we need – Thomas Jefferson said once he'd rather have a government – newspapers without a government and government without newspapers. Like all politicians, once he got elected, he changed his mind. But if we don't have – what I'm scared is that we've got more and more models of information, more and more access, but maybe less and less relevant stuff. I think we should all be concerned about that. I think the thing that bothers me – you're really draining my intellectual resources here. I'm saying everything that I know, which isn't much. But what I think about a lot when I'm laying in bed at night – looking at the ceiling and wondering if I have to replace the roof this year, I think people my age, say I'm 62, maybe between 62 and 45, I know that we had a common set of intellectual furniture. We knew this, we learned the same stuff. We got news from the same place. You and I have never talked about the Civil War, but I know you know when it is. I know, you know, you could probably name the planets in order. I can't, my students, I don't know where they get their news from. People don't sit around and watch the 6 o'clock news or 6:30 news with Walter Cronkite anymore. They get it from a variety of places or they don't get it at all. And so we're seeing people, and I'm sure this is true at MSU, have mind-boggling gaps in what they know or what they don't know. If you doubt that, give a class sometime a map of the United States, an outline map, and ask them to fill in the states. And you'll find out very shockingly that They don't know the names of some states, and sometimes they come up with things that aren't states and claim that they are. I had a kid that insisted there was a state called Tacoma. So, you know, it's that I think to be a people, to be a government, to be a country, civilization, you have to have a common bit of shared knowledge and shared myths, sort of the good myths. You know, that one good myth was that everybody in America could make it. If you worked hard, everybody could be president, you know, stuff like George Washington chopped down the cherry tree and couldn't tell a lie. Stuff like that is sort of good, common. It's common, rather around the campfire kind of stuff. I'm scared that we're losing that.
Well, Jack, as we close, then we've talked about a lot of things, but so we aren't perceived as old curmudgeons. In general, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
You know what the difference is between an optimist, a pessimist, and a Detroiter?
No.
The optimist looks at the glass and says, it's half full. And the pessimist looks at a glass and says, it's half empty. And we people from Detroit say, hey, who stole my glass? Overall, I think you just sort of have to be, you have to be optimistic. During the time of the Soviet Union, there was a Soviet dissident, and he wrote a poem, and he said, if they covered the whole world with asphalt, a crack would form in that asphalt, and in the crack, grass would grow. So, yeah, I am optimistic that, you know, that a sooner, there used to be a slogan, God looks after fools, drunks in the United States of America. So I think that you got to be conditionally optimistic, and but my optimism is based on we have to keep fighting. We have to keep trying to reach people one at a time. I'm not optimistic there's going to be any silver bullet solution. People in Michigan are still looking for, okay, the auto industry isn't what it is, but somebody's going to come in here, build a whole chain of big box factories, and put us all to work making doilies or something. It's not going to happen. We're going to have to sort of make our own. But I'm optimistic that we will, that we will if we want it.
Jack, thank you so much for sharing your insights again with me on MSU Today.
You must have been desperate, but it was an honor to be here.
Jack Lessenberry from Michigan Radio and Wayne State University has been my guest, and I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future. This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, our guest this week provides the leadership for academic programs for one of Michigan State University's premier colleges. And the vast majority of those programs are deeply rooted in sustainability. She is Dr. Kelly Mellenbaugh. She's the Associate Dean and Director of Academic and Student Affairs in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. She's also a professor in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's give our listeners an overview of the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, something you and I know well, but maybe some of our listeners out there don't know quite as much about.
Well, the College of Ag and Natural Resources is an exceptionally exciting place to be. One of the things that I want to always share with people when I talk about the College of Ag and Natural Resources is we've heard a lot that, well, our student number is going down in the College of Ag and Natural Resources. That is not true. We are actually at the highest enrollment that we have been at in the college since the early 80s. We've got almost 4,000 undergraduates in our four-year academic programs, and we hover right around 650 graduate students in our master's and PhD programs. And then a lot of people may not be familiar with it, but we also have a two-year certificate program through our Institute of Agricultural Technology, and those numbers are around 340 students. But we know that ag tech is going to continue to grow because we've seen those numbers starting to creep up over the last couple of years. Another interesting fact I think that is interesting for the college as a whole is we're split about 50-50 between men and women. Women are just a little bit higher than men within the college. And at the undergraduate level, we offer about 19 different majors for students to participate in, anywhere from areas of entomology, fisheries and wildlife, School of Planning, Design and Construction, packaging, community sustainability, all kinds of different areas that are really critical when we think about food, energy, and the environment.
Well, Kelly, before we get into some of these specific majors and programs, et cetera, there's a lot of talk these days about developing what President Simon refers to as a T-shaped professional. I know that you've been involved in that from the inception. I know the College of Ag and Natural Resources has long been doing these sorts of things, but this is a new term in the lexicon of higher education.
The T-shaped professional, I think, is very exciting. Actually, I experienced what we used to call a T-shaped curriculum when I had worked in the environmental science and policy program. And that was really about how do we get interdisciplinary breadth and disciplinary depth for a student in terms of their academic training. That T-shaped professional now takes that concept and builds on it with regard to things like professional development skills, conflict resolution, and so on, so that students are essentially not only prepared academically, but they have other skills that they can bring to the table when they get out into the workplace to make them even more valuable and critical for the workplace.
Now, Michigan State University is at the forefront of this, not just the College of Ag and Natural Resources, but Michigan State University is working very closely with some key corporate partners who have a big stake in this.
Yeah, we actually, Michigan State University and IBM actually hosted a conference out in California back in March around the T-shaped professional and introducing what this was all about and why it's important for us to be thinking about the T-shaped professional. Next year in March, East Lansing, Michigan State University, will actually be hosting the second conference, and we hope to get more people from campus involved in that conversation so that we can talk about how do we actually create these T-shaped professionals. It's also a partnership. It's a partnership between universities and the workplace because we're both responsible for creating these T-shaped professionals.
It would seem to me, too. We've featured STEM on this program a couple of times, but there's a nice integration there between the T-shaped professional and the whole emergence of the STEM phenomenon.
Yes, and one of the things that I really hope that we're able to do as we continue to move the college forward, I often hear that the College of Ag and Natural Resources is not a STEM college. It is a STEM college. What we do is deeply embedded in science, yeah, technology, engineering, mathematics. And part of what we want to ensure people understand is we have just a huge and rich breadth of opportunities for students who are STEM-interested students within the College of Ag and Natural Resources.
And when the college, along with the College of Engineering, I mean, I think you have hosted STEM conferences here on campus. In fact, one not too long ago.
Yes, and one of the things, too, that the College of Ag and Natural Resources, College of Natural Sciences, College of Engineering, and Lyman Briggs College have actually been working over the last several years to talk about STEM and how to advance STEM. We started in a couple of areas in particular around how do we help support faculty in the STEM discipline. So we have a STEM Teaching Essentials workshop, but now there's also the STEM Alliance, Create for STEM, that's being housed out of the College of Education. There's lots of things that are really going on campus. It's very exciting around STEM, and it's pulling all of our core colleges together to talk about these issues and to advance them across the campus.
So as I think about this, when I think about STEM on that T-shaped, I think more of the vertical T. That would be your science, technology, engineering, math. But then the horizontal T, you mentioned some of those things, communication skills, conflict resolution.
Yes.
Is the integration of those, is that
absolutely
right?
Absolutely, the integration of all of those. So that what we're really doing is we're creating students who, again, not only have that rich disciplinary and interdisciplinary understanding, but they've got the skills and abilities to make them highly successful in the workplace.
My guest is Kelly Mellenbaugh. She's the Associate Dean and Director of Academic and Student Affairs in the College of Ag and Natural Resources. Kelly, there is a new department in the College of Ag and Natural Resources, and the name of the department really hits right at the heart of sustainability. Tell us about it.
Well, this is essentially the Department of Community Sustainability. Actually, this is a department that's been on campus for a long time, but it actually resulted in the combination of three other departments historically, and they just adopted their new name a little over a year ago and have been doing a lot of work in terms of redefining the department, coming up with a new name of Community Sustainability, but then using Community Sustainability as really their focal point, not only for their academic programs, but also for how they're thinking about doing research, where they're going in terms of outreach and extension as well.
When we talk about community sustainability, we can talk about a lot of things. And as you said earlier in a conversation we had, you can define sustainability in a number of ways.
Yes.
But community sustainability gets at what the College of Ag and Natural Resources has always been good at, agriculture, natural resources, and environment, but then adds a different and greater dimension.
Yeah, I'm very excited about the academic programs that the department has worked on over the last year or so. They've done a lot of work to really think about the three majors that they're now going to offer in this area. And I'm excited for our students. One of the programs that they actually offer is environmental studies and sustainability. The other one is sustainable parks, recreation, and tourism. And the last one is ag, food, and natural resources education. The nice piece about those three majors is that they actually share a common core of sustainability courses. So everything is grounded in these sustainability courses, and then students have the opportunity to pursue one of the three majors. I'm very excited about all three of them, and in particular, I'm really excited about the education major. We know that that's a pressing need for a lot of our students to be trained to become essentially education teachers in the K-12 level, and we believe this is a really nice gateway for those students to become educated with a focus on sustainability as a part of that training.
Yeah, and just in the names of those majors, I mean, to look at the practical application of this, two of Michigan's top three industries are directly, are core.
Yes.
to those programs.
Yes. One of the other things that I would like to offer, too, is that through community sustainability and through the RISE program that we have on campus, starting in fall of 2015, the RISE program will actually be offering a minor in environmental sustainability studies. And while students who are in the RISE program are automatically enrolled in that minor, Other students from across campus are welcome to be a part of it. And it's very exciting because students have an opportunity to get some very hands-on opportunities and experiences. We have students who are coming, say, from the Business College, College of Ag and Natural Resources, College of Natural Sciences, all over the place. So you're also then not only getting an interdisciplinary look at sustainability, you are bringing students from diverse backgrounds in who now get to talk about these issues with one another and share their perspectives on how they're approaching sustainability.
And RISE is an acronym for Residential Initiative on the Study of the Environment.
Yes.
RISE program. Well, let's put this, let's drill right down here in an area, given your background in fisheries and wildlife. I'm a biology major over in the College of Natural Sciences, and why would I want to be involved? I'm already getting my major in biology. What would the RISE program, what kind of value would that add to my undergraduate education?
So one of the things that I think is really amazing about the RISE program is that hands-on opportunity. So just as an example, some of the work that the RISE program is involved with the specialization, is an opportunity to interface with our student organic farm. And that's one of, I think, one of the nicest pieces that we have here on the campus, is to provide students an opportunity to get out, see what the student organic farm is all about, get their hands dirty, engage in that experiential learning, and then be able to take that experience back to the classroom and make sense of, what did I just see while I was out there? What did I just do when I got my hands dirty? And interface it with the information that they're actually learning in the classroom. So it's a very nice opportunity for multiple ways of learning.
I'm talking with Dr. Kelly Mellenbaugh. We're talking about sustainability-related programs in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. Kelly, let's move beyond the Department of Community Sustainability. Let's look at some of the study abroad programs. And you mentioned earlier the two-year ag tech program. Also, those programs, many of which are grounded in sustainability.
Yeah, one of the things, obviously, Michigan State University has a long history of amazing study abroad experiences. The College of Ag and Natural Resources offers about 50 study abroad programs for our students, and we have several of them that very purposely focus in on sustainability. One of the programs that we have is actually a sustainable tropical agricultural systems that's actually offered by a faculty member in entomology, and that's actually based over in Sri Lanka. It's an opportunity for students to see a very diverse country, not only in terms of natural resources, but also agriculture, an area that has a lot of pressure on it from a variety of sources, and try to make sense of, how do I manage this? How do we think about sustainable natural resources? How do we think about sustainable agriculture? Learning about it in a global context, and then also bringing that experience back to Michigan State University and the courses that they have here. I am a huge proponent of study abroad and making our students global citizens, because it really changes the way in which we think about how we solve the world's problems. So that's one example of another area that we like to focus in on, is giving our students these study abroad opportunities. We also have the Institute of Agricultural Technology, our two-year program, and we have several programs that do focus in on sustainability. Our dairy management program is actually one of our most sought-after programs, and it gives students really a deep hands-on opportunity to see what the dairy industry is all about, how to think about it from a sustainable perspective, and so on. And we anticipate that is one of our programs that's growing. We continue to anticipate that that program will grow into the future as well.
Well, the study abroad programs, I know that you have directed study abroad programs in your faculty life, and I did as well, New Zealand, Australia, and we looked at those kinds of integrated systems over there, and being with students 24/7 like that and watching the amazing transformation that happens, I mean, it's an incredible experience.
It's an absolutely incredible experience. I have an opportunity oftentimes to talk with our incoming students as well as their parents. And one of the stories that I always share is about study abroad, because it's a wonderful experience for me as a faculty member to engage in it. But the best part about it is watching the students go through that experience. You can actually see the change happening right on the spot with them. I have a wonderful story about a young woman who went with me on a trip to Australia. She'd never been out of the state of Michigan, never been on a plane before. And she came back a completely changed individual. It was all about her being able to show that she could really stretch her boundaries. And once she did that, she was much more willing to continue to stretch those boundaries, and she's gone on to lead a really successful career.
And isn't it amazing, sometimes we get so American-centric here, we go abroad and we see some of the wonderful things that other people around the world are doing to sustain their environment, their climate, and what have you, come back, we don't have all the answers.
That's exactly right. And I think that what it allows us to do is recognize, just as you were saying, we don't have all of the answers, and we can learn from everybody in all kinds of different places about how we need to be thinking about how we're using our natural resources, how we're working within agriculture, how we can be more sustainable. And it's those little tidbits that help us really challenge ourselves to think more creatively about the ways in which we advance agriculture and natural resources here in the United States.
Well, for parents and students who are listening to this interview out there, Kelly, if they want more information on the College of Ag and Natural Resources, undergraduate programs, ag technology programs, study abroad, where can they go?
They can essentially, I would encourage them to start at our website, which is www.canr.msu.edu. All of our information is listed there, and I would encourage individuals to contact my office as well as even any of our departments. Lots of information is available first and foremost on the website, but then also we've got a lot of really dedicated people within our departments and our units who are more than happy to answer any questions folks might have.
And that is the iconic College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, deeply rooted in sustainability, but doing more and more with sustainability with each passing year. I've been talking with Dr. Kelly Mellenbaugh. She's the Associate Dean and Director of Academic and Student Affairs for the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. Kelly, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai, and even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network, people who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
Recycle Michigan, a place where there's no city limit, no boundaries, and the population, 9.9 million. So where is Recycle Michigan? It's located in your home. Next door, down the road, in your very own community. In their continued effort to increase recycling awareness, the Michigan Recycling Coalition has launched the statewide Recycle Michigan campaign. Serving as a resource to both businesses and residents, the Michigan Recycling Coalition provides simple steps to reduce waste, create awareness of the benefits of recycling, and to discover options for recycling through your local communities. By recycling, you, your family, your neighbors, and your community can help protect the things we love most about our state. Recycling junk mail, water bottles, and other containers will help keep our Great Lakes State clean, but it also promotes job growth in Michigan. Discover how you can become a citizen of Recycle Michigan by exploring MichiganRecycles.org.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
So building winning teams put on by the Broad Business School gave me an opportunity to interact with not only alums in different business fields, but people that have been successful or are in leadership positions around around the country and around the state of Michigan.
That's Timbo Gracchus from the MSU Alumni Association. A year ago, he attended the inaugural Building Winning Teams, a Quest for Excellence program.
I think the professors through the business school bring the knowledge base and the academic side of things and some real-world experience that they've had. And then getting to hear from our coaches in that kind of a setting is always phenomenal. You don't get a chance to sit down with big-time head coaches at a university like Michigan State very often and to share and have that communication and more of a conversation and less of them just sitting there and telling you, you know, from their perspective how things are. So,
Building Winning Teams is a program designed to help managers rise to the managerial challenges and opportunities they'll likely confront in their careers by building sustainable skills in the area of leadership and team effectiveness. It's a collaboration between the management faculty in the Broad College of Business and the coaching staff of the Department of Intercollegiate Athletics at Michigan State University. It's June 3rd through the 5th at MSU's Henry Center for Executive Development.
Well, in my mind, building a winning team could encompass anything from the women's golf team at Michigan State all the way down or all the way through to a company, a business, a small business, a large business, because in order to be successful, you need to have a team surrounding you or that you're working with that needs to be successful in order to produce.
That's Big Ten champion MSU women's golf coach Stacy Slobodnik-Stoll, who will participate in the program again this year. Her fellow Big Ten champion coach Susie Merchant will be there too.
One of the things that we sell here at Michigan State to our recruits is the uniqueness of Michigan State's connection on campus with Team MSU. I mean, we're the front porch a lot of times, but certainly there's a lot of meat and potatoes that go behind it, as simple as that sounds. And it just is really a great opportunity, I think, to share what we do on a day-to-day basis and certainly get a better perspective of what other people do on our campus to make this such a special place and really sell Team MSU.
Tom Izzo, Mark D'Antonio, Mark Hollis, Kathy George, Jake Boss, and Tom Anastas will all participate in the June 3rd through 5th program, too.
Well, I hope to give them some ideas and maybe a different way to think about building their successful teams, because sometimes in athletics we do different things or we try and be very creative versus a business or a company, I think. So what I hope that the people who are attending get out of this would be just to have new and unique and exciting ideas that they can bring back to their companies, businesses, or teams to help them kind of kickstart some great ideas.
And for me, it's work ethic. I don't think anything happens by accident. I think you have to work for what you want. I definitely think that you have to have high character when you're doing it. Integrity means everything. Your word means everything. It's no different in business. And I think you have to be passionate about what you do. I mean, don't do anything you don't want to do. It really, to me, I love what I do, and I think it shows. So, you know, if they walked away from anything, I hope that, you know, they understood that those are the three things that we've kind of built our program on: work ethic, character, and passion. And those three things in and of themselves, I think, translate very well to the business world.
For more information on participating in Building Winning Teams June 3rd through 5th at MSU's Henry Center, visit edp.broad.msu.edu.
Again, I think having access to the coaches and just not only asking questions about our teams, but also how we've built those teams and how we have formulated successful teams over a long time was very interesting for all the participants.
I would recommend anybody from entry level to leadership position within a corporation taking the time and investing in coming to Michigan State and being a part of this great program.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The program is MSU Today. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with some observations from the Spartan life. We love our comfort zones. Even an uncomfortable status quo is preferable to the unknown. But things change. We outgrow a job, or the job outgrows us. Our relationship ends. A health crisis appears. Or the sting of an unhappy current reality becomes so great that we are forced to step outside of our self-imposed boundaries. This is one of life's great ironies. We often fight to stay inside the box when the very thing we need to fuel our future lies on the outside. This week, make a list of the things that are keeping you inside your comfort zone. How many of them are self-imposed? Every single one. The next chapter of your life's adventure will be written with or without your direct involvement. Maybe it's time to imagine what that chapter might be if your uncomfortable comfort zone didn't exist. As I was researching this week's message, I discovered this anonymous poem, which I've customized just for you. I hope it gets you thinking about those self-imposed limitations and the opportunities that lie beyond them. I used to have a comfort zone where I knew I wouldn't fail. The same four walls and busy work were really more like jail. I longed so much to do the things I'd never done before, but stayed inside my comfort zone and paced the same old floor. I didn't want to build the traits successful people share. I watched my friends advance and thrive, pretending not to care. I claimed to be so busy with the things inside the zone, but deep inside, I longed for something special of my own. I couldn't let my life go by just watching others grow. I held my breath, I stepped outside, and let the changes flow. I took a step, and with new strength I'd never felt before, I kissed my comfort zone goodbye and closed and locked the door. If you're in a comfort zone, afraid to venture out, remember that our heroes were at one time filled with doubt. A step or two and words of praise can make your dreams come true. Reach for your future with a smile. Happiness is there for you. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans AD Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.
MSU.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises
alumni.msu.edu. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, please click on the local tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.